update from the DNR on the situation with the wolf decertification, some of the issues regarding the reduced population of moose, and then an update on the fire in northern Minnesota. So why don't we have candidates that are here come up to the table, and we'll just kind of go down the line and get introductory remarks. You can tell us about yourselves, and then and whatever you would like to mention, and then we can take questions from members. Quorum is present. Okay, we can start from our left to right. Go ahead and introduce yourself. Welcome.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Don Schiefelbein. I am the first one on the list, and I have been appointed to the Citizens Board with a special responsibility as representing ag. My background has pretty extensive ag with it. I'm from a family farm in Kimball, Minnesota, where I operate that farm with seven brothers and a father. And people said, were you going to be nervous in front of this committee? And I said, if I can get along with seven brothers and a father, this should be a piece of cake. But all things relative, we run a fairly large seed stock cattle operation where we primarily market seed stock bulls to commercial cow-calf producers.
Very good. Why don't you just tell us why you'd like to be on the board?
Well, you know, it was interesting as this whole process evolved, and I think I probably have as little axes to grind as any person ever before this committee, because the whole approach was one where a couple of individuals came to me and said, hey, there's this opening in a very important committee. We like the way you think. We like the background you possess. Would you have a willingness to share your time and what talent you have with this group, and would sure like you to go through this process? From there, I actually had to get involved and learn the process, learn exactly the role of the board, and so it's kind of been a learn-as-you-go affair for me. And I think they were amazed as they went through this whole confirmation period, because every time they asked me, they said, well, exactly why do you want? And there is really, truly, the reason I want to do it is, as you know, the involvement of ag in these issues is extremely important, but the distance many people who are decision makers in the process have to ag has gotten further and further away from the roots of ag, so it becomes even more important that you involve somebody who can relay what ag means and what ag really is about to those people, and that's how the whole thing progressed.
Great. Thank you so much. Welcome.
I'm Chet Weilander. I live up by Bemidji. My address is LaPorte, but actually I'm just outside of Bemidji. I came to this board as a Teamster business agent appointed by Arne Carlson. I was asked by some unions, some of the umbrella groups of the unions, to serve on this board. And so Peter Larson was the chair of the PCA at the time, the commissioner. And so I've served a considerable length of time on this board. My interest here being on the board as a labor representative naturally is somewhat different than probably Don Schiefelbein or somebody that's from the environmental area of a concern here. We look at, how is it going to apply to jobs? How is a project going to apply to jobs? If there's a problem out there, is there ways of mitigating and protecting those jobs? Is it a danger to the workers? And if there are cases where workers are in danger, of course, that becomes a very big concern of mine. I'll give a good example. We dealt with a Coke refinery situation, or Flint Hills, today. And we had some very serious labor issues over there, and the company was willing to sit down and go through those issues, and that thing turned around considerably during the tenure that I've been here. And so these are the types of things that I look at from a labor point of view. My background basically is, you know, I grew up on the farm. I'm sure you have my history. I grew up on the farm. I went to Bemidji State University. I served in Vietnam as a war correspondent and a microwave operator repairman. And I taught school for a period of time, took some graduate courses, and then went to work for private industry in Bemidji until I was asked to come on as a Teamster business agent officer out of the Duluth local. So that's pretty much everything in a nutshell.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator and members of the committee, Senator Chaudhry. My name is Paige Weinbarger. I am a resident of Bloomington, Minnesota. I've lived there for 26 years. I am retired. I've been retired for 6 years from a banking law career that spanned about 33 years of banking and legal work as general counsel, and then prior to that, I spent approximately 15 years with the Federal Reserve System in Washington, D.C., and in Virginia as a bank regulator. I grew up in the state of Virginia and attended law school at the University of Virginia, but have now lived in Minnesota for 26 years. Since I've been retired, I have served on a number of boards related to conservation and the environment, including I recently chaired the board of the Nature Conservancy. I rotated off of that board last year. I currently chair the board of the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center in Roseville. I currently serve also as a member of the Forest Resources Council, the state council, and I am a board member of the Minnesota Valley Lands, which is a real estate holding company affiliated with the Minnesota Valley Trust, which works on land preservation along the Minnesota River. I am interested in serving on the PCA board because I feel that I'm at the point where I'm very interested in having my business and legal skills and financial banking skills coalesce with my passion for the environment and for wildlife. And when Commissioner Moore approached me about the possibility of being appointed to the Citizens Board, I was particularly interested in the opportunity to work with Commissioner Moore in his time at PCA. So I'm very eager to work at the state level, bringing together my skill set of legal, banking, financial matters, but also just applying good business and sound judgmental matters to issues that I think have a huge are hugely important to the citizens of Minnesota in protecting our environment.
Thank you very much. Appreciate all of your willingness to serve. Just to start with a general question for you folks to answer, what do you think are the most significant challenges to Minnesota's environment, particularly as it relates to the activities of the PCA? And any of you can start. Either of you can start. Mr. Scheffelmeyer.
Mr. Chair, I guess where I really think the crucial element comes in is trying to create a realistic, well-rounded balance between safeguarding and preserving the environment, but yet providing an environment for business and individuals where they can succeed. To me, the real crux of the position that we're involved with is making sure that balance is true and accurate and safeguards both sides of the equation. So on one end, you certainly want to do everything possible within realistic terms to protect the environment. But at the same time, you also have to understand the importance of business and individuals and what drives the economy in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Wielander.
I guess I would truly agree with what Mr. Scheffelbein has said here. One of the problems that we deal with, of course, is how do we maintain and improve the environment with what resources we have financially. It takes a good economy to have the money available to improve the environment. You know, what was acceptable 20 years ago or 50 years ago as far as where we dump things, today we're paying the price for that. And unfortunately, some of the people that were involved in it aren't around to help pay for it. And so consequently, when we look at our water situation, for instance, one of the big problems that we have in Minnesota is to clean up and ensure that we have adequate and clean drinking water and recreational water resources. And so consequently, in order to do that, we have to figure out how we're going to economically survive the cleanup. And that's a big issue, and it affects everybody from Minnesota to New Orleans. So it's a pretty that's probably the key issue that we have here right now.
Ms. Weinberger?
Yes, Senator, I would say there are two major interests that I have and what the challenges are for PCA. First of all, I'm as a citizen and as a member, as a longtime person involved with conservation, I am quite troubled by the decline in the last 5, 6, 7 years of funding that goes to the key state agencies. I mean, just the money in general that the state is spending on the environment, I think we all know, has dropped precipitously, and I think the challenges have gotten greater and the pressures have gotten greater. So I'm particularly interested in doing everything that we can to find the right balance and mix on funds, but also to make sure that the money we do have that we spend on the environment is being spent on the best opportunities for long-term gain. So the use of resources would be my number one answer. My second answer would be issues surrounding clean water. I think just the pressures on water and the issues that we have in the state to monitor, to clean up, are issues that I am particularly interested in.
One of the, we didn't go into this a whole lot with the commissioner, but afterwards, one of his comments really kind of stuck with me, and the question was asked about Minnesota's compliance with the Federal Clean Air Act, and he indicated that Minnesota is on the verge of not being compliant. And so I'd like to maybe ask you folks what you feel as members of the board you can do about compliance with the Federal Clean Air Act. Mr. Wielander, why don't you start
this
time?
Okay, that's fine. One of the big problems that we have, of course, is we receive a lot of power from coal-fired power plants, and that does create some problems as far as the issuance of pollutants. We did have, on at least two occasions that I'm aware of over the years, testimony at the PCA and presentation by the University of Minnesota, the Department of Health, and the PCA. And quite frankly, we're very fortunate in this state to have some of the top people as far as environmental issues and solutions are concerned of any place in the world. And, of course, with the power plants, it's the PM10s and the mercury problems. But what has been impressed upon me in these discussions is the fact that We've had companies that have gone to China or Mexico or wherever there are no restrictions. And the Chinese power their industry by coal that is far dirtier than ours. And unfortunately, it's my understanding that if we totally shut down the power plants, we probably would still be on the verge because we've got so much floating in the upper atmosphere. And, you know, it's really an international problem. It's not only multi-state, but it's international. And until we can get a handle on some of these trade agreements to try to alleviate some of these international problems, it's pretty hard to take care of things here because economically it's not something at this point, as I see, as being feasible. You know, we can do what we can do, but we also have to look at the bottom lines.
Ms. Weinberger.
Having three board meetings under my belt, I don't think I can give you a real specific response to actions that PCA can take relative to keeping Minnesota in compliance with the Federal Clean Air Act. I certainly include that in my in my general objectives to use the PCA staff and resources as wisely as possible for clean air and clean water and all of the issues that we're doing to protect the environment. Beyond that, I don't have a specific thought at this stage of my orientation to the board. Thank you.
Mr. Schaffelbein.
Yeah, I guess where I would kind of fall on this is more of a defining the role of the Citizens Board. And to me, we have to be real careful to make sure that we don't evolve that position into an activist role where we are leading the charge necessarily and it's our mission, whereas we have elected officials like yourselves who are truly knowledgeable in the areas of carrying out some of those laws, creating the laws. And we got tremendously competent staff who, if you've ever attended a Citizens Board meeting, we'll see they give you an extremely good preparation material to give you guidance as far as where the real strong points are on this issue, what you need to consider. So as far as creating agendas and carrying agendas out, from my personal standpoint, I'm not sure that's a role I would like to partake in, though obviously it's very concerning that you would never, you know, want that to get close to where we are in violation.
What then is the role of the board?
The way I see the role of the board is to be that intermediate party to when there are very tense or difficult decisions where you need that third-party, outside, unbiased viewpoint is where should we fall on this decision when there's a disagreement between parties on a very important issue.
Okay. Did we get answers from all of you on that? All right.
I would add, Senator Chaudhry, I would add to Mr. Schaffelbein's comment that I see the role of the board also as being very much advisory to the commissioner and in that capacity providing citizen perspectives from a variety of venues to the commissioner and to the agency, and in that way being a liaison between the citizens and the agency.
Senator Vickerman.
I would add to that one other thing here.
The Wielander.
Agency is the board, according to statute. And so consequently, the board is obligated to be involved in policymaking and to help to establish through staff input what proper mechanizations there are to solve some of the problems that are out there. The other part of this whole situation, though, is the ability to be a listening post, because we do have some very diverse points of view out there that we have to deal with, and sometimes they can't be dealt with administratively or politically, and we are kind of the sounding board there. And, you know, we try to base our decisions on state statute and what is in the record. That's what we attempt to do. Sometimes we get our fingers slapped by the courts, but we've been pretty fortunate that the courts have borne us out on many, many occasions.
Senator Bickerman.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a more of a statement than anything. I serve as the chair of the Agricultural Committee, and I would hope that all three of you would at least look at that. That can be environment, too. We don't unintentionally do bad things as farmers, but just remember we are all in this together. I've always said this, and I'll make this statement right here. The best environmentalists in this whole country are farmers. We don't goof our land up. We don't goof up our water. I just want you to keep an open mind for that.
Maybe a follow-up to that. How do you, perhaps on the issue of feedlots and permit applications, we folks were talking about balancing the needs of business and agriculture and the environment. How do you envision balancing that need to respond to the permit applications with regards to feedlots in particular and giving adequate environmental review? And Mr. Scheffelbaum, you are the resident farmer. Give us your perspective.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, that's a wonderful question. And really, what it really comes down to is every situation is so unique as it is presented to that citizens board. As you well stated there, as you present these various options, what may be right for one situation may be entirely wrong for the other situation. The way I see it from a board standpoint, and I'm not sure which of my colleagues here said it, but from a citizen's perspective, somebody has to sit back, evaluate the information as it's presented, and say, what is truly the right answer in this given situation? And for some, it may be the exact opposite answer for the very same, for like circumstances where the situations are slightly different. And to me, that becomes, and that's what the balance that I think you're referring to, becomes the very difficult part in this, in that if it were all the same, you wouldn't need us. If it was a rule that said this is the rule and that's the way it is, there would be no need for us whatsoever. The problem with rulemaking, and you're probably keen to this, is the gray area that rulemaking creates. And once you create the gray area, then you need the group of individuals like ourselves who most importantly are unbiased and willing to listen to the whole picture.
Give me an example as it relates to your experience in what a different situation would mean.
A perfect example is, let's say two individuals want to produce exactly the same facility. Okay.
What type of facility are we talking
Let's
about?
Let's say an agriculture feedlot, just to put the example right back for where you'd like it. Okay. Now, in one example, the person is building the feed yard. His house is 500 feet away. His son's houses are 1,000 feet away. He's literally surrounded with his family. He has to share the burden of the process, just like everyone would expect. On the other case, you have somebody who buys an 80 acres of land, sticks it into Dr. Dill's neighborhood and says, well, what's wrong with having a feed yard there? It's within code. I would have very different responses to those two situations because one very much is in line with the realities of what feed yards do and is willing to, if you will, share the burden. And the other is a complete contrary where they're saying, yeah, feed yards are great because we're good agriculturists, but by the way, I don't want one in my backyard. We're going to put it in your backyard. Different answers, similar situations.
You would support granting the permit in one situation and not in the other?
Not necessarily. I'd have to – what it would do for me, Mr. Senator, is it would raise my eyebrows as to – the rest of the story and what else is entailed, because I have a pretty good hunch you watch what people do and not what they say. And they may say the feed yards are great, but if they don't want one in their backyard, pay a little bit more closer to what they're doing and not what they're saying.
Thank you. Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I think I'd like to just expand a little bit on Don Schiefelbein's background. He farms in the same township that I do, Kingston Township. And the family farm that he is operating, 4,000 acres, 700 beef cows, like you mentioned, seven brothers, a mother, father, and so forth, is a real family operation. And not only is it the best farm in Kingston Township, or one of the best farms in Meeker County, or one of the best farms in Minnesota, it's one of the top seed stock producers in the entire nation as far as Angus bloodlines go. It's a very high-test operation. I put out a book that this was presented to this committee at one point earlier this session about how livestock is good for the environment and good for the economy. The Schiefelbein farm is a perfect example of how livestock is good for the environment, because on their farm they got over 100 miles of fence. They're doing a lot of pasturing, a lot of haymaking, and the corn stalks are often left untouched by tillage in the fall so the cattle can graze in the wintertime. There's very good environmental controls on that farm. It's a beautiful, excellent run farm, and it's a true example of how livestock can be good for the environment. Now, Don has got a brother who is on the Meeker County Board of Soil and Water Resources board at the county level, and a sister-in-law is on the Kingston Town Board, and is a very active family. And one thing that's a little off the subject, but you might be interested to know, that Don's dad was the head of the mental health task force for both governors Carlson, Ventura, and Pawlenty, chaired that mental health task force. And when Governor Ventura had trouble with his Playboy interview and saying idiotic things to the press and so forth, the staff called in Frank Schiefelbein, Don's dad, to give Jesse some points on how he's supposed to act. At any rate, he's from an excellent family, and they practice excellent environmental practices on their farm, and I think he'd be a great addition to, I know he'd be a great addition to the Citizens Board.
Well, the other thing is that I understand the Schiefelbeins participate or practice excellent labor management. Schiefelbein, you probably know what I'm talking about. Various brothers have been...
I thought you were referring to the fact that Dad used us as slaves as young people, but then I rethought that's probably not what you were getting at.
But now
exactly. What we have is we have a diverse group. There's eight brothers, and the only way you get eight brothers to get along is you let them each have their own area of expertise. And that's where Bob actually is our feedlot permit specialist, and he's the one who's on the Clearwater River Watershed Board. But each one has their own, for lack of a better term, domain. But each one of us, as part of our domain, is supposed to somehow contribute back to volunteer organizations to try and make sure our message is clear, concise, and well said to the rest of the industry, and especially to you all.
And it's not just domain. Each of you were sent to a particular school to get a particular degree in that expertise, and how that was accomplished without...
It's interesting.
Is remarkable.
What's interesting is one of the rules Dad had, and I think those of you who have children will share that view, is the only way Dad looks smart is for you to go somewhere else. And so what he basically did is he shipped this off one by one to various colleges throughout the country, and through the process of hard knocks, et cetera, and I think we've got... and I think it's seven different land-grant institution graduate degrees at our place, that basically you become familiar with a different area, you start understanding that not all people are the same, different regions have different needs, and I truly, truly am a believer that when you come back through that process, your parents are a whole lot smarter. And I truly mean that.
Same deal. Mr. Chair, members, one other thing I forgot to mention is this urban sprawl problem, which I'm concerned about, and many of us are concerned about the fragmentation of ag land, forest land, and so forth. Thanks to the Schiefelbeins, there's 4,000 acres of land that's been protected from urban sprawl in our neighborhood, because they've got an entire lake on their farm, part of almost another entire lake. The Clearwater River runs through there, and all that area is protected from urban sprawl because they're successful agricultural producers. And I'd rather have the Schiefelbeins buy another farm out there than have somebody else buy it and cut it up into little dinky pieces and sell it off for lots and clutter up the neighborhood with urban sprawl. So for those of us interested in controlling there, this is a perfect example. Their farm is a perfect example of how farmers help control urban sprawl.
Further questions from the members? Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for being here today. If you recall, I'm Katie Stephen. I'm a senator from Cottage Grove. And, of course, you're very familiar with the 3M pollution that has taken place in my district and throughout the East Metro area. And I have a lot of questions, but I'll try to keep it to this. I'm sure you've all had a chance now to look at the proposed consent order between the Pollution Control Agency and 3M. And, well, first, if you have any general comments, I'd be happy to hear that if you have had a chance to review it yet. But my question is about the Mississippi River. As you probably know or you could remember from the presentation, the company dumped tens of thousands of pounds of PFCs directly into the Mississippi River. And my understanding is that because PFCs weren't a regulated substance, it sort of was allowed. But now there's a fish consumption advisory on the Mississippi River, and there's very high concentrations of PFCs in the sediment of the Mississippi River. My review of the consent order shows that there's nothing in it that addresses either the cleanup of the river or the sediment, or or any real ramifications for the company for polluting that section of the river. And I was just wondering if you have any comments on that specifically and what role the Pollution Control Agency should have. And I guess I should also just say for the committee members, and we're going to talk more about this at a later date, but maybe tomorrow. This consent order that came out on Friday has huge implications for how the response to the cleanup and what costs are going to be borne by the state of Minnesota and its taxpayers well into the future. And so the proposed consent order is obviously very important, not only to the people in my district, but also for the future of the state and how this is addressed. So if you have any comments on that, I would appreciate it, especially as it relates to the river and the pollution of the river.
Ms. Weinberger, why don't you start this time?
Thank you, Senator Chaudhry. First of all, I have not read the proposed consent order. I received the package in the mail at my home on Tuesday, and yesterday I was all day attending the Forest Resources Council's spring board meeting, so I've not read it. And I guess the other comment I would make is that it's my understanding that as board members, we aren't going to be expected to have to give specific information in testimony on items before that are pending before our board, just as a matter of our board procedure. But I have not read the consent order. I will assure you I'm spending time this weekend reading it before the board meeting, but I was reading Forest Resources Council materials through yesterday.
Mr. Shuffelbein.
Yeah, obviously, that whole situation is, for lack of a better term, it's just ugly. And the best thing we can do now is what's the best process to get the citizens of Minnesota the best resolve on that issue. And I think I can say, without going into the specifics, because I think they really do want us to keep from doing specifics, so in respect to you, but I still want you to understand my perspective, is that we've got an obligation on that board to do everything within our power to get everything pre-disposal of chemicals as we possibly can. If that means cleaning up the Mississippi River as part of a bigger project, then we ought to do that. But our goal must be to get it equal to pre-chemical dumping. So without going into the details, I hope you understand my position on that.
I wasn't going to have any additional testimony beyond the candidates, but I did chat with the commissioner just now, and this relates to the fact that they actually have a quorum present with the board, and to comment on it would, without notice, a proper public notice would be problematic, and that's the reason behind the the reason why you can't comment. But you can make general comments on some of the issues that Senator Sieben talked about, particularly general issues relating to the Mississippi River, fish consumption advisories, and PFCs in general.
Senator Chaudhry,
Ms. Weinberger,
if I could add just one more issue as it relates generally to the protecting the Mississippi River and the Minnesota River. I personally have a lot of years of personal commitment and financial contributions where I've worked very hard personally on issues that affect keeping the Minnesota River clean and the Mississippi River clean. And as I mentioned, so protecting these rivers is a huge personal objective of mine, and I've had a lot of years of efforts put that I personally have put into doing that, and certainly will be balancing how strongly I believe that is important in my decisions.
Mr. Wielander.
Once again, because we do have a quorum here, I just can't comment directly upon that settlement agreement. And next week we will have all parties available to discuss that. With that aside, I'll say this. I've been on the board long enough to know that a situation that we have in hand, time is of essence to get it taken care of. And so it is a very important situation. Yes, the Mississippi is important, but there are a lot of things that we need to do in rulemaking and various other means to establish the means to take care of these problems. And at this point, we don't want to put the cart ahead of the horse here because everybody has to have their day in court, so to speak. And at this point, it hasn't been done.
Well, what are your ideas?
What are my ideas? My idea is that what was acceptable 20 years ago or 50 years ago when this started isn't acceptable today, and it wasn't until fairly recently that problems started occurring in other areas of the world relative to fire retardants and Teflon chemicals. And, I think that my first knowledge of this was probably through a National Geographic article on these issues about 2 or 3 years ago. The fact of the matter is that there wasn't a realization that these were problem chemicals, and so we've enjoyed the uses that they've produced over the years, but now we have a problem. And we're going to have to deal with that problem, and we're going to have to deal with it in a proper sequential order.
Senator Sieben, you have a follow-up?
Well, not in response directly to any questions that were made. I'm looking forward to the hearing, whether it be tomorrow or Monday, on this issue because, again, just for the committee members and the public, it's really important to realize that there are matters in this proposed consent order that the Pollution Control Agency is, the commissioner is recommending be adopted that will have very broad implications for the future of the state and how the cleanup is addressed. And again, not to be too dramatic here, but we're talking about people's drinking water, roughly 75,000 people who have affected drinking water and who have various PFCs in their drinking water, and how that cleanup will be handled is obviously very important to me.
Mary Ann, Ms. Hecht, when are we? Are we hearing that tomorrow? We're going to get an explanation and a summary of the consent order tomorrow, and we are going to have the PCA, the Attorney General, here to go through it. Further questions for the candidates? Mr. Scheffelbein, we were looking for some additional paperwork from you. I don't see it in our packet yet. I think what we'll do is just make sure that we get it between now and when we vote on the floor. And that'll have to be before Monday. Monday's the latest we can vote on it. Okay. Does anyone have a motion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fredrickson.
I would move that the nominations be forwarded to the floor with the recommendation that the Senate do affirm their appointment.
Okay. Senator Fredrickson moves that the... What's the exact... That the nominations of Donald Scheffelbein, Chester Wielander, and Paige Weinberger be forwarded to the floor with the recommendation to affirm the appointment. Any questions on that motion? Any further discussion? All right, seeing none, we want to thank you for being here and for your willingness to serve on this board. It's time-consuming, and you all have other businesses that you attend to, and we understand, citizen legislators, the time it takes. So thank you for your service. So, all in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dennis, can I get this to you on the floor?
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
She's not here, so we couldn't.
She'll let us know that.
If there's time today. Oh, you know, we went through all these
okay.
Hopefully, I don't know if there'll be time or not today.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay, we'll see.
I don't know. You're in session. Do they need because we let them know.
Okay. The next item on the agenda is DNR updates. We're going to start with wolves, moose, or fire.
Mr. Chair, we're thinking wolves and moose.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife. I have with me Mike Don Carlos, our Wildlife Research and Policy Manager, and Lou Cornicelli, our Big Game Program Leader. And you asked for an update on wolves and moose. These are two species that have been in the news quite a bit lately. Wolves have been a success story in terms of populations increasing and being recently removed from the endangered species list by the federal government. Moose, the news hasn't been so good. We've had problems with the moose population in the northwest part of the state for a number of years. We've got two distinct populations of moose in the state. The northeastern population has been faring much better, but there's growing concern in recent years even about moose in the northeast because we're seeing mortality there that's unexplained, and we've been doing research. So we didn't prepare a lot of detailed information for this hearing. We thought we would just give a brief bit of background on those two species and then just respond to any questions that you or the members may have.
Great.
So with that, I would ask Mike Don Carlos to give you a little bit of background where we're at with wolves, and then after that we can do moose.
Great.
Thank you, Ed. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thanks for having me here today. As I'm sure many of you are aware, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service delisted or removed the gray wolf in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Michigan and portions of a few adjacent states from the protection of the Endangered Species Act, the federal act. And that rule took effect on March 12th of this year. So Minnesota is now, for the first time in a generation, actively and responsibly managing wolves again. Some of you on the committee, I'm sure, well remember this, but during the late 1990s and culminating in the 2000 legislative session, Minnesota went through a process to prepare for this event, and a bill in 2000 that was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor amended various game and fish statutes to put us into a position to responsibly manage wolves. And the Department of Natural Resources, following extensive citizen involvement in that legislation, completed a state wolf management plan in 2001. We expected delisting to follow soon after that. It's now 6 years later, and it's happening, but we're glad that it's finally happened. But the groundwork has been laid, and I have copies of the plan, and it's available online if any of you would like to see it. There are a few or several details in the plan that are yet to be developed procedurally. We'll be working on those this summer. We have had a wolf research scientist on board for about 3 years now, doing primarily population survey work at this point, and we're very close to hiring a program specialist, a wolf specialist position, and we'll have that position filled in June, and that person will coordinate and implement, fully implement our state management plan. So we're pretty excited about this. Wolves are in good shape in Minnesota. Our population is, the range is stable. The actual numbers have increased according to our last census. And we believe that wolves will thrive in Minnesota under this plan. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about wolves that you might have.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Don Carlos, why are you glad they were delisted?
Probably the biggest reason is the goal of the Federal Endangered Species Act is to recover species, to remove the threats and restore those species to viable populations. And we've done that with the wolf, and it's important. It's important that that be recognized, and that the Endangered Species Act remove those species no longer in need of attention, so that we can move on to other more pressing needs. So, that's the biggest reason.
And then, what are the key points of the plan?
There are a number, Mr. Chairman. The plan includes a lot of monitoring and basic biology so that we stay on top of our wolf population and know what's going on. The plan sets a floor or a minimum population threshold at 1,600 animals that we will manage so that we never fall below that number. There is no upper limit. And the plan provides provisions for dealing with a wolf-human conflict, which is the greatest need and arguably the most important aspect of promoting public tolerance of wolves on the landscape. And our management plan is somewhat different than the federal approach in that it empowers individual landowners and livestock owners to take more direct control action than was allowed under the Endangered Species Act. There was wolf control while wolves were listed, and there will continue to be that kind of control, plus with a little more empowerment of individuals. There will be no public hunting or trapping seasons under state law for the first 5 years of this plan. Five years from now, from March 12th, the Commissioner of Natural Resources can consider public taking, but must do a public process and involve the citizens of the state in making a determination as to whether we're going to harvest wolves. And there are many other provisions, but those are some of the highlights.
All right. So what are all the empowerment items?
Sure. And the plan defines two management zones in the state, and they're available online. Essentially, Zone A is the northeastern third of Minnesota, and Zone B is the rest of the state. And in Zone A, which is the core wolf range, and which is where about 80% of the wolf population resides, where wolves and humans come into conflict, the benefit of the doubt goes a little bit more to the wolf. In Zone B, it goes a little bit more to the landowner. The specific difference is under state law, in Zone A, a person can shoot a wolf to defend human life and can shoot a wolf that is posing an immediate threat to livestock or domestic pets. and the threshold of immediate threat is there. You can't just shoot a wolf that you encounter on your property. The wolf has to be actively pursuing and threatening your animals. In Zone B, the immediate threat threshold is not there. So an owner of livestock on his or her property, if they're concerned about the protection of their animals, they can take a wolf on their property. In all cases, these animals have to be reported to DNR within 48 hours. All evidence preserved. We will investigate these cases to make sure that, you know, that they were done within the law.
So Zone B, they can be shot on site.
By owners of livestock on their property, if in their judgment they feel they need to do it to protect their animals. Yes, that's correct.
All right. So if it's on their property and they just recently sold all their cattle and there aren't any livestock on there, then they can't shoot it.
That's correct.
Okay. And then what was the – you said it was our plan is different from the federal plan. How are they different?
Under the federal plan, wolves could only be taken by DNR or federal authorized wolf control agents, and that will still continue under our plan. The difference is that now there's this provision for individuals to take action as well.
Okay, all right. Is that the plan? Refers to those. What you can do in those two zones, or is there anything else in the plan?
Well, there are a number of things in the plan. A description of there's a history of the wolf in Minnesota, a description of prey management concerns, disease management, descriptions of how we're going to staff, and those kind of things. So the plan is fairly comprehensive.
Okay. All right. And so what other things are being done in the wolf management plan?
Well, recently, since delisting, we've made staff assignments. For example, we now have three designated conservation officers in northern Minnesota who are contact points, both internally and externally, for wolf complaints and wolf problems. As I mentioned, we've had a research biologist on board for about 3 years, and we're working now to fill the specialist position. And once that's done, we'll be working with the U.S. Department of Agriculture Animal Plant and Health Inspection Service Wildlife Services, which is the federal agency that is currently doing wolf control. And we hope to enter into a cooperative or contractual agreement with them to implement some of the additional depredation options in the plan. We continue to work with the International Wolf Center in identifying public information needs, and that will continue. Those kinds of things are going on.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sharon.
I am a new member, so when you're referring to 1990s, are the things that we're missing that created the need for this protected species, the absence of our ability to determine the numbers? Did we not have a base number, and were we not tracking that? Was there no regulation around human and wolf contact? Those things you're talking about that are in the plan, were those absent at that time? Or what was the reason for the problem?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, generally, no, they weren't. those were in place. Let me back up and give you a quick review of the history of the wolves in the continental states. In the lower 48 states, wolves were extirpated. They were eradicated in every single state except Minnesota. Minnesota is the only state that has had a continuous wolf population and presence. And so it is largely because of what's happened in other states is why the species was federally listed. Minnesota had a population of not less than 700 wolves at the time that they were federally listed. And if the other states had, you know, comparable populations, the listing wouldn't have been necessary. So Minnesota really wasn't the problem. The problem was is that we were, you know, all that was left. Generally speaking, what caused that eradication was direct persecution, a lot of it government sanctioned. It was a deliberate effort to eliminate wolves from the landscape, and we were largely successful everywhere except in northeastern Minnesota. And so the two big things that have changed now and the primary reasons we expect wolves to thrive in Minnesota is, number one, that organized persecution is gone and not coming back. Individual landowners killing a few wolves never caused the problem in the first place. It was wide-scale poisoning campaigns, aerial gunning, and government-funded and supported control. So we're not concerned about dealing with individual livestock problems at a wolf population level. The second thing is having adequate food available. And as everyone knows, we're in the good old days in Minnesota for deer numbers right now. And in Minnesota, white-tailed deer are the primary prey for wolves. And we expect that to continue. And so we've got just a really good, solid prey base in Minnesota. We've eliminated the persecution, provided more than adequate protection for wolves. And we're monitoring the population. We're staying on top of wolf numbers and distribution. We know what's going on. So we think we're in good shape.
Is poisoning going to be allowed as part of the landowner empowerment?
Mr. Chairman, no. Poisoning is not allowed under the game and fish laws and other laws.
Only shooting,
and then using certified predator control trappers under certain circumstances. So shooting by the landowners and some individuals will be authorized to trap, certified controllers.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Don Carlos, how many wolves do we have in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, our last comprehensive survey was done in the winter of 2003-04, and our population estimate was 3,020 wolves at that time. We're going to repeat that survey this fall. We'll get an updated number, and then we'll do it again 5 years from now. So there's a confidence interval that's fairly broad. The population is not less than about 2,200 and probably not more than about 3,600 right now.
Mr. Chairman, hello. Mr. Don Carlos, just a couple other questions. Is there an upper limit where you would consider additional control measures to keep the population below a certain level?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, no, there is no upper limit in our management plan, and we're different from some of the other states in that regard.
And Mr. Don Carlos, one other question from a story that was in the media here a few days ago. Why was the wolf chasing the car? And did the wolf ever catch a car, and what did he do with it when he got it?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fredrickson, I successfully avoided media contacts and dodged that question.
But we got you right here now.
Yeah, you do. You caught me. I don't know that anybody has a good answer for that question. As we all know, dogs chase cars. Some dogs do it. Some dogs don't. It may be some sort of an innate response. I'm just speculating to try to answer your question, but I would guess that individual wolf somehow had gotten beyond its fear of roads, cars, and people, and that allowed it then to express this chasing behavior. But that's just speculation.
Wow, that wouldn't have been good.
It's probably not, not a lot of survival value from a wolf's perspective in behaving like that. But
any other questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of them were answered, but Maybe you said this before and stepped out of the room. How many complaints have we had on the wolf versus livestock in Minnesota over the last 2 years?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I'll give you a general sense of it. Over the last 10 years, we have killed between 100 and a maximum of 200 depredating wolves per year in Minnesota. And these are wolves that have been killed in response to livestock losses. The number of complaints, in a given year would run in that 100 to 150 range. Not all of them are verified, but of those that are verified, we do remove wolves. So, in terms of the threat to livestock, wolves will take livestock. They do in Minnesota. They do everywhere else. It's a problem that needs to be addressed. From a broad picture, the good news is It's not a great threat to livestock because it's a fairly rare event. However, if you're a livestock producer that has a wolf problem, it's a very serious event. And so it's very critical that the state continues to address those conflicts and resolve them. And to the extent that we do, we can have more wolves on the landscape.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
To that number of wolves and the potential for increasing conflict, is there a reason why we don't have an upper limit? Is there what is the thinking behind that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sherrod, there really isn't a need for an upper limit. Wolves and deer will work it out. There are lots of factors that will constrain wolf numbers, and they're not going to increase exponentially. They're not going to be 6,000 10 years from now. So they will regulate at that level. The key is to make sure that where they're causing problems, those problems are addressed. And in our view, by saying that we don't want more than 1,000 wolves because more is going to be a problem, really isn't the best approach. Whether you have 500 wolves or 5,000, you need to be addressing those individual livestock problems. And if you do and resolve them, then, the number can be larger and can be more flexible. The reason that the plan has a floor number in there, not to go below 1,600, is to avoid getting back into the situation that we were in, which caused federal listing in the first place.
And members, the Senate is under call. We're going to recess for members to go vote. We will come back and discuss moose fire, and Ms. Batiste is here as well. We'll consider her confirmations. Committee's in recess.